The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, this is Bruce Valanche. Remember on Hollywood Squares, the guy to the left of Whoopi, if that's possible? I'm listening to John Orlando on the PVD cast.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 328. I hope all is well with you, and I'd like to thank you for checking out this episode of the PVD cast. My guest for this installment is a gentleman by the name of Cody Clark. Cody is an independent filmmaker and poet, hailing from Brooklyn, New York. And I was really interested to talk to Cody. And, you know, he has a very unique philosophy about filmmaking and being an independent filmmaker. I think that what many people sometimes don't understand is that you might get a, quote, indie film, end quote, but it's really funded by a corporation. Fox Searchlight, for an example, or A24, they have a large corporation behind them. So it's not a problem for those type of movies to get $2 or $3 million to shoot a film. What Cody's going to tell us about is about making independent films for hardly any money. As a matter of fact, we're going to talk about a movie that he made for like $50. And it's really fascinating. I'm glad that he came on because, as you all know, if you're a longtime listener, you know that I am DIY when it comes to my podcast. So I can appreciate that independent spirit. And so we're going to talk to Cody about, of course, Kill the Lion Films, which is his production company. We're going to talk about all of his various films that he's made over the years. And we're even going to talk about his poetry. So it's going to be one interesting and insightful episode. And again, I'm glad that you're checking it out. So before we get to my conversation with Cody, though, I need to thank one of my great sponsors. And of course, I'm talking about World's Greatest Comics. I say it time in and time out, every single episode of the PVD cast, that World's Greatest Comics is a great comic book store. And if you don't believe me, you should stop by the store and check them out. They are located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. You can check out all of the things that they have, including single issues, graphic novels, collectibles, hundreds upon hundreds of back issues, various collectibles, comic book supplies, posters. Again, their particular selection is awesome. Now, I know many of you are like, I'm listening, John, in Brooklyn, or I'm listening, John, in Paducah, Kentucky, or I'm listening wherever. You can still check out the store. Just go over to the website, wgcomics.com, and you can check them out on their Facebook page, which they're pretty darn active on. Just search for at WG Comics. Again, I thank Jeff and all the fine folks at World's Greatest Comics for being a sponsor of the PVD cast. Their support means a lot to me, and I truly, truly do appreciate it. Please, folks, give your patronage to World's Greatest Comics. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, you're going to hear my conversation with filmmaker and poet Cody Clark. Ladies and gentlemen, this afternoon I'm sitting down with a filmmaker, a poet, a writer. He's got lots of things going on, and I can't wait to talk to him about all of those projects. Mr. Cody Clark. Cody, how you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing good. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking a little bit of time out of your busy schedule to sit down and chat with me. I do appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, you are the man behind Kill the Lion Films. So let's start off by letting the listeners know, why did you start Kill the Lion Films?
Well, I started it in 2011. It just seemed like the thing at the time to, you know, if you're going to start making movies yourself, you might as well put it under some studio name besides your own name and, you know, make it feel a little bit bigger and kind of represent what you want to do going forward. And for me at the time, I was thinking about two quotes in particular that were motivating me very much. One directly influenced the name, which is a line from a Charles Bukowski poem. And the line goes, when things get bad enough, the kitten will kill the lion. And the preceding line to that poem as well is, true revolution comes from true revulsion. When things get bad enough, the kitten will kill the lion. And for me, that represented everything I wanted to do as far as independent film and what I dub truly independent film, which is not studio influenced and not secretly studio funded like much of independent film these days. It's actually just people just making the movies themselves. And I felt like the kitten that will eventually kill the lion, because I could see where the puck was going to be, so to speak. I could see where things were going, and I could tell that things were just going to get more independent as people realized, you know, it's not just that we can make vlogs ourselves or little YouTube videos ourselves. We can make, you know, pretty damn good movies ourselves too, feature length films. So that was a quote that really inspired me and directly inspired Kill the Lion Films. And the other quote was from Jean Cocteau, which was that film will only ever be an art form when its materials are as inexpensive as pen and paper. And when I heard that, I was just kind of mind blown, because I never really considered the fact that film was an art form that hadn't really been formed yet. And it's true. If the only books that existed or the only art that existed in any form was gatekeeped, and the pens and paper were kind of handed out by gatekeepers, and pens and paper cost, you know, an arm and a leg, we wouldn't really say for sure we knew what literature or illustration was or anything like that. So why do we assume that we know what film is yet? You know, film's only 100 years old. That's an infancy for an art form. So everything that's come before in terms of film is really just mere prologue to what's being developed now and what we're seeing and learning film can be through what people are doing with very low budgets and completely by themselves.
Springboarding off of what you've just said, do you have a background in filmmaking, or are you a DIY type of guy, if you will?
You know, like anybody else who does what I do, I've done freelance projects here and there. You kind of pick up experience along the way just by getting paid to do things that you learn how to do, and you feel confident that you can, you know, be paid for doing. So ever since I started, I was doing little odd jobs and learning that way. But I would say around high school was when I really started getting into making films and the idea of making films. But I still didn't think it was a reality necessarily, because it wasn't until the DSLR cameras started coming out, which were kind of the game changer for me and a lot of people, where you could make a film that looked like cinema to me. Before DSLRs, your films would look kind of like DV. They'd look kind of like home movies. They'd be shot on some sort of camcorder with some sort of mini DV tape. And while I appreciated that people were doing that, it wasn't what I wanted to see on screen as far as what I thought a film should look like. But when DSLRs came out and suddenly we're using these, very high-end for us digital cameras that were traditionally used for still images, and you could get one of these cameras for the same cost as like a camcorder, suddenly we were able to make movies that looked and felt like maybe an independent film from like the early 90s or late 80s, that kind of aesthetic of like 16 millimeter that we were chasing and wished we could play around in, but where it was cost prohibitive, of course, to shoot on film. Those DSLRs kind of gave us a taste of being able to do that. And that's really how I made my first film. So I was kind of, there was this crossroads, right? Because if I wanted to learn DSLRs, I couldn't go to film school to learn them because they were just coming out. And so I'd be learning them at the same moment that so many other people were learning them, including the people that would be teaching me how to use them. So I, instead of going to film school, which would have cost hundreds of thousands of dollars, I paid a couple thousand dollars for a DSLR, which I think I probably crowdfunded at the time. And I just started feeling the camera, feeling my way around it, seeing what its likes and dislikes are, because of course, every single camera has likes or dislikes. You can't spend enough to get around that. You know, you can get a $50,000 camera and it will still have likes and dislikes. No camera's perfect. And if you have a good relationship with your camera, if you know it well, you'll be able to produce good images for sure.
Sound advice.
It's the advice I generally give. You know, it's something that's still fresh, new information for a lot of people, even though we're about 10 or 12 years deep into this era of DSLR filmmaking.
Well, let's talk about a couple of your films. So I've went through your catalog, and I just would like you maybe just to give us a little bit of background on it, or maybe just, you know, your comments on it, whatnot. I'm going to start with one that, because I love Jaws, it's my favorite horror film. I really enjoyed No Shark. So you want to let the listeners know as to what this dark comedy is all about?
Well, first of all, I think it says a lot about how good No Shark is that you liked Jaws and liked No Shark, because a good portion of No Shark is spent talking about how bad Jaws is. And I love Jaws. You know, it's the character saying it, not me. But at the same time, I do agree with a lot of her issues with Jaws, which honestly have nothing to do with the film and just have to do with how sharks were viewed in the ocean afterwards, and which has led, you know, sadly to a lot of unnecessary shark death, because that movie portrayed sharks as an enemy when really they are not that statistically. But No Shark I see it as an existential shark movie. So there's no actual shark in No Shark. And in No Shark, you know, spoiler alert, it's about a woman who wants to be eaten by a shark. And it's about all the things that are going on in her head that lead her to want to do that. And it's about her pursuit. It's all just inner monologues and beautiful footage of beaches around New York City as she just kind of goes around and tries to be eaten by a shark. And it's just a very weird movie, but kind of like a visual novella. You know, I feel like comic book fans would key into it, or people that are into novels in general. It's more of like a literary experience than it is a cinematic one, but I think it has its foot in both worlds. And the response has been great. Particularly Japanese people have adored that movie, which is really exciting, because none of my movies had really ever broken in Japan before. And it's just about to come out in Japan, I think, in about a couple weeks. And there's thousands and thousands of Japanese fans that are just raring to go and can't wait to see it.
That's awesome. That's got to be like a huge accomplishment. You know, you got to have a lot of pride about the fact that you've broken through in a different country, or have some of your other films broken out in other countries as well.
Well, a film I did a couple years ago, Attack of the Giant Blurry Finger, which was a film where I was using forced perspective by just having my finger in front of the lens and making it look like a giant blurry finger. I would just kind of run around the house with Chloe, my girlfriend, and just chase her with my giant blurry finger. And that, it was just about that for an hour, if you can imagine that. And that hit really big in Brazil and Indonesia. And I wasn't distributed in Brazil or Indonesia. They're all just pirating the movie. But for some reason, they heard about it. They checked it out and they just translated it themselves and spread it around. So suddenly she and I have all these fans in Brazil and Indonesia that we would have never had if not for piracy. So that's one of the pluses of piracy, I would say, because it would have been impossible for me to distribute there otherwise. But they took it upon themselves that if something clicked and they wanted that movie, and they made sure they got it.
I was gonna say, it's very much sticking to the theme of kind of do it yourself, DIY.
Yeah, exactly. I think piracy is probably one of the most misunderstood concepts going on today, because it still has this odd connotation when really in practice you see it's very similar to, you know, archival work. You know, a lot of films that people pirate, it's not just Marvel movies or whatever that they don't want to pay to go see. I think most people who want to go see Marvel movies still pay to go see them in theaters, for sure. What you see a lot with piracy is you see people chasing movies that never got proper releases or are out of print or something's going on. And it keeps films alive for them to be able to be accessed in some way.
Well, sticking with that theme of the DIY, Artifact of Love, did I read correctly that you made that film for $50?
Yeah, that's well, it has two titles. It has the titles Artifact of a Love and the DVD. So it's a bit of a confusing project in that I call it the DVD, and it's technically called the DVD because Artifact of a Love is it's a fake movie in that it's made by fictional characters. So I was playing around with the concept of like, all right, what if instead of actors just playing characters in a movie, what if actors created a work of art that I was technically writing for them, but they went through the process and these characters made something? I got addicted to the idea of like someone who's not real having made something, because I think that's not played around with in film too much. And yeah, we made that for about $50. It was a very quick, easy project because the movie that the characters were making, they were making for $50. But I've made films for less money than that, if you can believe it. I've made a couple films for around $50. Definitely my documentary Rehearsals, which was my second film, and I just shot for the cost of MetroCard rides because I already had all the video and audio equipment I needed for my first film. So I just used all that over again. And my only real cost was just MetroCard rides. And Attack of the Giant Blurry Finger, I made for literally $0. It was just me and Chloe in quarantine or whatever, you know, in those early days of the pandemic. And we just made a film on my iPhone. And so I wasn't even using any equipment that I had. There was no, you know, asterisk there whatsoever. It was just literally just me and my iPhone and her. And, you know, you could make a movie for $0. It's possible. I don't recommend it to somebody who doesn't know their voice in filmmaking yet, but it can be done.
Well, let's talk about one other film before we start talking a little bit about the Oscars and whatnot. You have a horror film called Ramekins. And I think the reason why I wrote that down is that it seems like many of your other projects are kind of a little more down to earth and a little more, you know, I guess you could say straightforward than rather than having a horror film where there's some twists and turns maybe. Did you enjoy working with this genre? Did you find it to be problematic? Was it easy for you to do?
I like it a lot. It's a genre I care about pretty deeply, and I want to keep making Ramekin films. I made Ramekin in 2018, and I made Ramekin 2 Ramekins in I guess last year. Man, time flies. So it's just a story that I really connected with. I definitely like, there's probably half of my movies that play a little bit more towards fantasy, and the other half is pretty grounded in reality. And Ramekin is definitely probably the craziest fantasy oriented one, other than probably Attack of the Giant Blurry Finger, right? But Ramekin and Ramekins, it's just about, you know, what if there was this little porcelain dish, which, you know, that's what they're called, by the way. They're called ramekins. And, you know, people in the service industry, they know that term well. But sometimes, you know, people outside that haven't heard the term before. But I just was always fascinated by the word ramekin and how it kind of sounds a little bit scary for something so innocuous, right? Just a little porcelain cup. So that was the motivation, was like, all right, maybe there's something there because the name is weird and it hasn't been really pointed out or used before. So I went from there, and I just kind of came up with this kind of Goosebumps-esque, you know, kid-friendly horror concept about a little porcelain dish, because it just didn't seem like something I wanted to turn into like a hard R horror or anything. It just seemed like kind of an idea that like a kid could have and a kid could want to make, you know, running around the house with a camcorder. So it's definitely probably my most family-friendly film, Ramekin, and also probably Ramekin's Ramekin 2, although slightly older audience there. It was really fun to do. Jamie, the lead actress, she's somebody I found on Backstage, which is an acting database. And once I saw her face, I just saw the movie. And she was the first person I saw when I was, you know, looking up casting for Ramekin. And I didn't even have a finished script yet. I just kind of had a basic gist of an idea. And once I saw her face, I just kind of wrote the rest of the movie pretty fast. And we have a great working relationship. We're good friends. And we just want to keep making more Ramekin movies. That's kind of like my Friday the 13th or my Halloween. That's something I want to keep coming back to for sure.
You know, you've mentioned here that you obviously, you said that the actress's name was Jamie, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So Jamie inspired you. You've been inspired by a bunch of other concepts and whatnot, such as the dishes themselves or Jaws or whatnot. So when does inspiration hit you? Is there a specific time of like when you're super busy and that's when you get inspiration, or does it just happen just whenever?
Well, that's a good question. I think momentum is really beneficial to artists, more so than ideas specifically, because if you have momentum, it almost doesn't really matter what the ideas are, because you can kind of find something there. I think people focus too much on whether they have quote unquote good ideas or bad ideas. I don't necessarily believe in good ideas or bad ideas, because if something hasn't been made yet, you don't know exactly what the angle is going to be on it, so to speak. So I don't ever really dissuade people from ideas other than like ideas that are beyond their means. So if somebody wants to make like a $300 million movie, I'm probably going to discourage them from the fact that like they don't have those resources. Unless they're like a billionaire, they don't have those resources to play with. But if somebody, you know, has an idea that could be done for a couple thousand dollars or even maybe about $10,000, you know, I don't care what the idea is, because I just know that like if it fits the price range as far as a budget, you can definitely make it, and it can probably be something. A lot of great movies just have weird ideas, I would say. You know, they only don't seem weird when they're executed properly. So I treat ideas as kind of a dime a dozen, and I only really care about if an idea writes, because I've had plenty of great ideas for movies that just didn't write, so to speak. So what I mean by that is if I sit down in a chair and I try and write it, it just doesn't feel right. There's something broken about it, even though the idea might sound great to me or a lot of other people. It's just not an idea for me, or it's not an idea for me right now or something. Whereas some of the stupider ideas, so to speak, they write really well and they go areas that I wouldn't have anticipated, and they become kind of intelligent in some way that they wouldn't have been on the surface to someone who just was looking at it as just the idea. So I think momentum, and what I mean by momentum is like coming off a project instead of like resting and like relaxing too much, you don't let your creative muscles atrophy. You just kind of go into the next thing, and you get this kind of superpower of like being able to make stuff happen. So if you, let's say you finish making a movie and then within maybe 6 weeks, you're already planning the next film, it'll be a lot easier to make that next movie than if you took a break, because you do atrophy much like stopping exercising. You just kind of forget what it's like to make a movie, even if you made dozens before.
I'm going to interrupt my conversation with Cody for just one moment to talk to you about World's Greatest Comics. As you know, they're a great sponsor of the PVDcast and also your one-stop shop for all of your comic book-related needs. They've got single issues, graphic novels, toys, collectibles, posters, back issues, a great pull system, a clean store, a friendly staff, They are 5 stars all across the board. So check them out online. Their website is wgcomics.com, or you can find them on Facebook. Just search for @WGComics. And better yet, if you're in the Central Ohio area, stop by the store. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And if you interact with anyone from the store, please let them know that you heard about World's Greatest from yours truly, right here on the PVD Cast. Well, let's talk about a recent project that you worked on. You participated in the Joel Haver Oscar Challenge, I guess you could call it. And you produced a film called Oscars, and that's possessive, O-S-C-A-R apostrophe S. And I got to say, the film was great because I anticipated one thing, and then it kind of took me down a different avenue. So could you walk us through maybe a little bit of the production on how you came up with the concept?
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, a little bit about Joel Haver's project. Last year, instead of watching the Oscars, he decided to make a movie while the Oscars was on. And I watched when he did that. I've known Joel Haver for years now at this point, as a friend and also just, you know, a fellow filmmaker. And he inspired me last year. I was like, man, I want to do this next year. And like, I told him, you know, not too long before he did it again this time around, except, you know, of course, this time around, he was encouraging others to do the same. He wanted to see, you know, how many filmmakers out there would, instead of watching the Oscars, just make a feature film. And so I told him like, yeah, I'm going to do it this year. And he was like, great, I'm going to do like this whole contest and I'm going to encourage others. And, you know, me and him and a lot of other people, we kind of assumed like maybe a dozen people might do it because it's a big ask, right? You know, making an entire feature film in like three and a half hours. It's kind of crazy on its surface. So we assumed a lot of people wouldn't do it, but actually, I think the final count is like 580 films were made that night.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. All in the same 3-hour time span. A lot of them first time filmmakers, by the way. And that's a lot to bite off and chew, as a first time filmmaker. That's like, you know, that's boot camp for sure. But a lot of people did it, and I've gone through maybe about 400 of them so far, not fully gone through. Like I didn't watch all of them in full. I kind of just tried ones here and there and saw if they were like terrible or not. And, you know, a lot of them are terrible because it's, you know, a lot of people's first film and there's such time constraint and all that. But I appreciate every single person that made the attempt because I think everybody became a better filmmaker just by doing that, you know, just by forcing themselves to make a feature film in 3 hours, which we're defining it as 40 minutes or more because that's apparently the Oscars cutoff. I think most people assume a feature film is like 60, 70, 80, 90 minutes. But for some reason, the Oscars cutoff is 40 minutes. So we kind of just assumed, you know, that as the amount of time. But yeah, I've watched a lot of them. I've watched maybe 20 or so that I think are genuinely good, you know, and that's amazing. The fact that like 20 movies were awesome that were made in like 3 hours instead of watching the Oscars, that's fantastic. And I still have, I guess, 100 or maybe 150 left to go through. And I'm excited about going through those and what the final count is. But for my own film, which I was going to make, you know, regardless of whether he did the full contest for other people or not, I just kind of always assumed like, oh, next year I want to do that instead of watching the Oscars. Cause I don't really care about the Oscars. Doesn't really mean anything to me. I would much rather make a movie and show people that you can make a movie. So my film was called Oscars, and yeah, with the possessive, with the apostrophe before, the S at the end. And it was about a made up kind of New York City tradition. It's kind of like a mockumentary where it's a, you know, a fake documentary about a party that's held every year in New York City called the Oscar Party, which is like this weird art house thing that goes on where this mysterious person throughout the year has been watching you and everybody else in New York City and is giving these arbitrary awards to people for random things they did in the previous year. So somebody might get best smile, you know, in New York City, or somebody might get best apology. So all these people that get these mysterious alerts that they've received an Oscar award, it's kind of like a Banksy thing. It's kind of a thing where nobody knows who the artist is. You know, they all show up to this secret location. It's a different place every year, and they just receive their awards. And the conceit was that me and Chloe were, for the first time in history, we were hired by Oscar, who we don't know the identity of, but we were hired by him to document one of these Oscar parties, which usually nobody knows they happened until after the fact. So when you watch the movie, you're just watching that be documented. So it's a pretty involved, you know, concept for a movie. It's not easily explained. But once you kind of get the gist of it, I think we did some really cool things with it, and it was all improvised. Other than the basic idea of what was happening, which was explained to the actors, nobody knew what would really actually happen when we actually did it. And it went in various directions I never could have predicted. And everybody had a blast doing it. And it was me and Chloe and probably about 21 people in total. And we just made a movie in 3 hours. And our movie is actually like an hour and 43 minutes. Because it was basically like a 3-hour party that we documented from start to finish. And we ended up with more usable footage than I ever could have imagined. And I'm really proud of the movie. It's awesome. It's on YouTube for free right now, along with all the other movies made during Oscar night. So it's really exciting. And Joel's going to do some sort of award ceremony, maybe in a month or two, giving awards for, you know, best movies made during the Oscars. And, you know, I almost feel kind of disqualified for that because, you know, I've made a ton of movies already. A lot of people making these movies during Oscar night, maybe they've made one, maybe they've made two, but usually they've made none. So I kind of, you know, I don't necessarily want an award. I'll appreciate an award, but, you know, I think it should go to people that are, you know, just starting out. Because I'm probably a little too experienced. It's kind of not fair because I was able to make a much longer movie and whatnot. But it's really exciting and it's really cool.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing, because you have written several books of poetry. So I wanted to just ask, when did you start writing poetry?
Well, I started writing poetry in 2014 as a regular habit. I would say ever since I was probably 13, I would kind of write sparingly, or quote unquote, when the impulse, you know, struck me, or when the idea struck me or something like that, which is how most people write. I would say most people, they wait around and see when inspiration takes them somewhere. I was sick of waiting around. You know, I wanted to approach it from a kind of a path of like diligence of like, all right, every single day I'm going to write a poem, because I like writing poems and I like how they come out when I do write poems, but I write them so infrequently, yet it's something that brings me joy. And so like, what could it mean creatively for me if I were to really just say every single day I'm going to write a poem? And it was honestly, it was probably the best thing I ever did for myself creatively. It was, you know, exercise. It was lifting weights. It's how you, I truly believe it's how you get yourself in shape creatively. Is you have to do, if it's not poetry, maybe it's a drawing, or maybe it's something, or a joke. If you're a comedian, maybe you write a joke a day. Just the mere act of doing that is just such a good thing, because what I truly believe is that, you know, every artist has a muse. Every artist has something in their head that's beyond them, that they're a vessel for. You know, something comes through you as an artist. You can force it, you know, you can fake it, you can do that, but we all know the moments when something is coming through us creatively. And I wanted to kind of show respect to that by saying, almost like I was conducting seances every day of like, look, I'm going to be here in this location, typing on this keyboard. And if the muse wants to show up, the muse shows up. And the muse kind of saw my diligence and showed up when I would write poems. And I think that built a solid relationship with whatever is within me creatively. And it made it so that, you know, since 2014, that's been the most productive creative period of my life. I've I've written 20 or 30 books. I've made, you know, 9 feature films, you know, and beyond that, like other stuff creatively I've worked on too. It's all been since 2014, and it's all been since writing a poem a day. And I've never missed a day. You know, that's thousands and thousands of poems since 2014. And every time I hit 200 poems, I just put them in a book and sell it on Amazon, because Amazon makes it pretty easy to self-publish and list books on there. So I don't really care if people buy them or not buy them. They're just, I want them available. And mostly I just want people to, you know, explore doing something every day creatively. Because I think if you really do show yourself to be diligent, you as a vessel will be used by something deeper within you or in the ether, creatively, that will come through for sure.
So there was never a moment of hesitation when you collected your 200 poems and you say, I'm going to put this on Amazon. There was never a moment of hesitation where you say, you know what? I did this for me and for my creative forces and whatnot. And, or did you say, no, somebody can get something from this?
Well, you know, I'd show them to people along the way, and people tended to like them. And so I just kind of assumed, like, you know, if somebody likes, you know, a couple of them, maybe they'll enjoy the experience of, you know, the whole book. Or even if they don't, like, there's plenty of books I've thumbed through where I like some of it and I hate the other stuff or whatever. I just kind of felt like, you know, Amazon makes it so easy. You literally just upload the PDF of the inside of the book and you upload the PDF of the cover, and it goes up there, and there's no overhead. You don't have to order copies. It's just a book is printed whenever it's ordered. So if that hadn't been the case, you know, I would have sat on the poems, or I would have posted them on a blog or something. But no, there was never any impulse to hide them. They weren't that private, you know, and anything emotional or weird about them, it's really just in a fantasy context. It's not any of my true feelings necessarily. It's just all explorations of concepts, and I'm mostly playing with language rather than I'm playing with, like, you know, actually expressing myself when I write a poem. I kind of just, my whole thing is like, I don't think about a poem before I write it. I don't think about a poem after I write it. And when I am writing it, I'm just writing what I hear in my head. I'm just a stenographer for the muse. Is how I could best describe it. I'm just writing down what I hear. And I think that's part of why the muse kind of respects me and understands that I'm a good vessel, is that, you know, I just write down what the muse has to say. I try and imagine, like, if I were a ghost or something and I had no, you know, solid arms or fingers or anything, it's like, what would I want? I would want somebody who, you know, with no judgment, would just sit down every day and let themselves be a vessel. So I think of the muse as almost like a ghost, and I'm just a vessel for that ghost at a certain time period every single day. And I take that same approach when I'm writing screenplays, where, like, sure, I'm kind of steering the story as I go, but as I'm writing it, I want to be as surprised as the viewer, so or the reader. So I don't really think about where a story is going. I just kind of accept that it'll go somewhere, and I'm along for the ride just like anybody else. You know, some of the best mystery writers have said that if you want a mystery that's really going to fool people and really surprise people, you yourself as the writer shouldn't know who did the murder mystery, who did the murder, until you actually have to write who did the murder. Because if you know who the murderer is going into writing something, there's going to be tells. There's going to be almost like poker tells along the way, where people are going to figure it out in like 2 seconds who the murderer is. But if there's a plausible deniability of you don't know it either as the writer, you know, you're going to fool a lot of people. So I take that same approach to storytelling. You know, if people know where my stories are going, I've kind of failed, because I've cheated them out of, and myself out of an organic experience with it.
All right. Well, let's start wrapping things up with one final question. Who are your inspirations when it comes to filmmaking, Cody?
My inspirations for filmmaking, you know, obviously, you know, friends and colleagues of mine. I like to see what people are doing in my same space, right? So you know, in that kind of low budget, yet not feeling cheesy or stupid or crappy production values or anything. People that do low budget stuff that actually like looks and sounds good. You know, friends of mine, so obviously Joel Haver, you know, he's an inspiration. And he's a much younger filmmaker than I. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, how old a filmmaker is or how long they've been doing it versus you. It's just about people with fresh takes that are doing it in their own way. So definitely friends of mine for sure. But as far as filmmaking, you know, there's movies you like, and then there's movies you can actually pinpoint as inspirations or filmmakers or screenwriters or whatever. Some of the biggest influences on me as a, and I would say as a writer, because as if I feel like because I write and direct my films, writing is just another process of the filmmaking. It's just, it's so intertwined with, the filmmaking process. So I would say, David Mamet is a huge influence. Maybe not as much as a director, but as a writer, I would say. Neil LaBute, he's a playwright as well, just like David Mamet. And I think I kind of gear towards some of these playwrights, right? Because, you know, when you're making a low budget film and you're making it good, usually it's almost like a filmed play. You know, it's so stripped down that it's just people talking a lot of the time. So it makes sense to be influenced by some of the greatest writers of dialogue the world has known. And as far as like visuals, I'm definitely influenced by earlier incarnations of independent film. So 80s, 90s, you know, people like Kevin Smith and Jim Jarmusch and foreign stuff like Aki Kaurismäki, Kim Ki-duk, a Korean filmmaker. You know, I can go down the list, but, you know, it's always going to be different for every single person. You know, I find a lot of younger filmmakers, they get influenced by a lot of crap that, you know, I didn't even have to worry about it being influenced by. So like some of their influences are like independent films that aren't even independent whatsoever. Like you'll talk to some of these younger filmmakers, maybe in their early 20s, and they're influenced by like very studio indie stuff. You know, they'll be like, oh, when I saw like, you know, some A24 movie. And it's like, dude, A24 is like, that's corporate, man.
Yeah.
That's not the same thing as somebody making something themselves. And so there's entire swaths of independent film history that are just lost to younger generations. And I think through my own work, I kind of keep those early incarnations alive and, you know, show people what movies can be as opposed to, you know, what's being crapped out by, you know, these Indian name only entities out there.
I will say real quickly, I mad respect to you for David Mamet, because there are so many people that do not even understand who he is or anything that he's done. And Glengarry Glen Ross is one of my favorite films and plays. It more people should know about David Mamet. I'm just gonna throw it out there.
Yeah, Mamet's fantastic. I've digested a huge amount of his work. I've read a ton of his plays. I've read a lot of his nonfiction writing. He's written some of the best books on acting and filmmaking. He wrote On Directing Film, which is, you know, indispensable. It's one of the best books on directing movies for sure. And he wrote a book called True and False, which is one of the best books on acting you could ever read. So, you know, he's just been super influential on me as far as concepts and as well as just great storytelling, great dialogue. And I think because, you know, it doesn't cost anything for two people to talk and have a good conversation. It just costs you time and energy of writing it down. You know, there's no inherent production quality cost associated with that. It's just if dialogue is compelling, you know, much like, you know, some of the best Tarantino scenes are just two people having a conversation. If a conversation is compelling, you know, that gets you 90% of the way there, I think, as far as a film goes. You know, anything other than that is just kind of icing on the cake. But it has to have some sort of solid core storytelling-wise. And that core can be had for essentially no money, because it's just voices. It's just actors, you know, delivering lines and whatnot. So, you know, I have lots of friends that love improvisation and incorporate that into their films. And I've done that to a certain extent. Oscars is probably my most blatant version of that. But more often than not, I just want to perfect the written word in some way in what I'm doing, and give people, you know, really strong dialogue to play with, because it doesn't cost me anything. Like I said, it's just my own time and energy in front of a keyboard for sure.
All right, let's talk about where folks can watch your movies, where folks can pick up your books, you know, social media, all that jazz, Cody.
Yeah, so on Amazon, if you just type in Cody Clark books or Cody Clark films or whatever, most of them come up on there. But, you know, I would say like I think 8 or 9 of my movies I have just up on YouTube for free. So feature length films up there completely for free. No ads even, honestly. No ad breaks whatsoever. You can just watch them on there. A couple of them are only on Amazon Prime Video. So like, usually when I come out with a movie, it'll go up on Amazon Prime Video first. So No Shark is currently on Amazon Prime Video. So you have to pay a couple bucks there. But most of my other movies, you can just access completely for free on YouTube. And Attack of the Giant Blurry Finger is also only on Amazon Prime Video. So I try and give back. I try and get my stuff out there. But, you know, most of the stuff, you know, even though it's free, you know, it's one of those things that like it's hard to get people to watch anything, you know. It's because you're competing with streaming, you're competing with all that stuff. And also if somebody's not paying for something, they're like, oh, I'll get to it later or whatever. So it's kind of a double-edged sword where like I'm getting my stuff out there in theory, but I'm still competing with, you know, Netflix and this, that, and the other, which is kind of an unfair comparison because it's a huge industry or whatever. But there are great feature length films completely for free on YouTube. My own stuff, Joel Haver's stuff, a lot of people's stuff it's completely free, and it's good quality stuff, and it's up and coming filmmakers, and I hope people explore that a bit more, because there's a lot of great stuff out there to be inspired by and also to be entertained by for sure.
CodyClark.com is your website, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And so if people want to check out links or anything, they're all available, I assume, at that website?
Yeah, absolutely. You go to CodyClark.com and also KillTheLineFilms.com. The way I operate is, you know, I kind of have a vote with your dollar philosophy when it comes to supporting filmmaking. So for $2 per month, you can support us at KillTheLineFilms.com. That comes out to, honestly, about a movie ticket a year, you know, which is pretty incredible. So for the cost of a movie ticket a year, you can kind of keep us afloat a little bit. That's really all it takes, you know, killthelinefilms.com if you want to support us, and CodyClark.com if you want to look at all my stuff that I've made and check it out for sure.
And that's Clark spelled C-L-A-R-K-E for those folks that are listening and want to jot that down. All right. So it makes it a little bit easier for you to find Cody.
Mm-hmm.
All right. With that, Cody, it's been awesome talking to you. I really do appreciate you coming on and spending a little bit of time with me.
Oh, absolutely. For sure. And you know, we didn't even get to talk about like wrestling and stuff. I know you're into wrestling. I'm a huge wrestling fan, man. You know,
okay.
I could have gone 3 hours on that for sure.
All right. Well, you know what? Now I'm challenged. I got to have you back in a little bit then.
Sounds good.
Awesome. With that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break, and on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up the episode. Well, there you go, ladies and gentlemen. My conversation with Cody Clark, talking about his film projects, his poetry, Kill the Lion films, and a bunch of other stuff. And definitely please follow Cody. Just go to www.codyclark.com to keep tabs on him. I hope that you enjoyed this episode, and you can let me know a couple of different ways. First of all, you can reach me via email. JohnOrlando@pvdcast.com is my email address. You can also leave me a message over on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is @PVDMVP. And you can even leave a message over on the Facebook and Instagram feeds. Just look for @PVDcast. And if you'd like to tell some folks where they can hear the PVDcast, well, it's pretty simple. Obviously, it's available through all of those major podcasting outlets. All you have to do is search in the search bar for PVDcast. Sometimes you have to put my name after it, and you should be able to find it. Also, it's available at pvdcast.com as well, the online home of yours truly. Now, if you happen to listen through one of those podcasting outlets or apps, you got to do me a favor. You got to rate and review the PVDcast. Rating and reviewing helps me out in the algorithm. And you don't have to do much. I mean, you just give me as many stars as you think I deserve and maybe drop a quick comment like awesome or great podcast. You don't have to write a lot, but it would help me out tremendously in the algorithm and in the ratings. Again, please rate and review and ultimately also subscribe so that you never miss an episode of the PVDcast. Let me tell you about a cool little thing I like to do Monday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that is to play the current episode of the PVDcast through the Facebook page. I like to call it a Facebook broadcast. All you got to do is tune in at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I will play the episode. And if you have questions, you can ask me questions. You can drop comments in the comment box, and I will respond. It's a real kind of cool way to kind of be a little more interactive, so check it out. Once again, that's every Monday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. I thank you for checking out the episode. So I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, stay safe and healthy. Presentation of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC. Copyright 2022.